Students Keel
has been working on that. I guess he's planning to submit today, unless somebody in the audience finds some bug in this argument, in which case he won't be submitting it today. So this is a effect to go after primordial gravity waves, potentially observationally. And the motivation here is in the context of inflation. That inflation is very successful in many ways, but most of these are really conceptual and qualitative, at least to date. Okay, if we look at the things, if you the nature of most inflationary predictions that can be tested are in some sense post-dictive, meaning that for example, to say we've got a scale invariant spectrum, well, heavens and lovely peoples proposed that in the early 70s, just based on not wanting fluctuations to diverge. Of course, in those days, if you had asked them 40 years ago, they probably would have said, well, the spectrum could be, would be close to scale invariant, maybe slightly red or slightly blue. Inflation does prefer slightly red or slightly blue, so, on a 1 and 2 kind of scale, it did predict a preferred deviation direction, but not a quantitative value. And we do happen, that look like it is slightly red and not slightly blue, so that's a good thing. But that's, it's kind of a qualitative 1 and 2 prediction that it makes, and what has been confirmed, but with only 1 out of 2 possibilities, really. Those guys, heavens and peoples, also categorized and said inflation perturbations could in general be adiabatic or isocurvature. And inflation, again, generically would predict that it's adiabatic, and it can be measured to be primarily adiabatic. So again, that's a good indication for inflation, but in some sense, again, qualitative. You've got 2 possibilities. If you had asked them 40 years ago, they would have said, well, 50-50 chance, and inflation did pick out the right one, 50-50. Okay, so if anybody's in betting pool on Pfeiffer, you see how probabilities go. So you can say, if anybody predicts the proper winner of this year's World Cup, does that mean that you really understood the dynamics of the team, or does that mean you got lucky? That's the question that's being asked here. And of course, other things, like the fact that the universe is flat or almost flat, people have been dealing with that problem, have been pointing that out. That's really a post-diction that people have been pointing out, that it's, even if it's not flat, it's almost flat. Known for a while. Again, one of those things that is currently very fashionable is to try to measure the tensor modes that, again, are generically predicted by inflation, and yet there's no generic amplitude prediction. Somebody won. So there you go. Half the people in the betting pool got the predictions right. Hope those were cosmologists. And so the current, one of the current observational agendas is to go after measuring tensor modes by, for example, cosmic microwave background polarization. And there, it's a similar situation as we are above. It's like the deviation from scale invariance that, sure, generically we predict that there could be gravity waves, whose amplitude is really a free parameter. That's not really betting on that is probably even less certain than betting on Fokker outcomes. So again, the question becomes, if it's such a situation, how would you know if you've confirmed a model when the model does not make a quantitative prediction? How exactly do you interpret a saying, oh, maybe the gravity waves, maybe they're large, maybe they're small, maybe not there at all, then I find them. Does that mean I've confirmed the model? So what exactly would constitute a precise, a precision measurement of a non-trivial prediction that wasn't qualitative? And there are some. Okay, for example, it's been well known that inflation, again, generic simple thing of fluid flow inflation, predicts a consistency relation of those tensor modes. So here's what is one of the quantitative predictions inflation could make. So if you saw if you actually measured, let's say, the scalar tensor ratio to some precision, let's say 1%, non-trivial order, non-trivial requirement probably, but if you could, And then you could say, well, I could predict what the deviation from scale invariance is of my tensor power spectrum. And these two, you know, now we've got two numbers that you can compare with. Okay, if this thing is 0.1 and this thing is, if this thing is 0.103 and this thing is all the 0.103, you say, well, maybe I've measured something non-trivially precisely. And the question is, well, what are the chance, no, what would we have to do to be able to test such a precision quantitative detection to you know, make a precision statement, you know, to an arbitrary, in principle, this can be tested to an arbitrary number of digits, well, to a large, it should hold to a fairly large number of digits up to next order and slow order, I suppose. But again, since R is known to be small, okay, so upper bounds, and R over 8 is even smaller, meaning that you better measure this spectral tilt to 1%, even today, even if the R was right below the Cohen's allowed upper bound, that still means you better measure the slopes to about 1% accuracy to convince somebody that you've tested a relationship. That's what the real non-trivial nature of this prediction is. It's not an entirely trivial thing. You've got to not only measure tensor modes, you've got to measure them at two different scales, and you've got to measure them to 1% accuracy on each of these two scales. That's what's needed to test a position prediction.
Five sigma or three sigma, if you say 1%, that's like 100 sigma or something.
You would have to detect, but clearly you've got to get R to at least 100 sigmas before you've got a chance of getting NP to one sigma.
I would see them in hypothesis gets at 5 sigma, and that's enough, I think, to test this.
So to test
this relationship, yeah, if I just measure tensor modes at two scales at 5 sigma, so that's 20%.
Well, it just says that NT is 0 plus or minus 0.2, whereas, again, generic, you know, if I had, I don't know, cosmic strings or something, or some other subdominant things at phase condition that generated scale invariant tensor modes, I would have said, well, you know, the first approximation, everything is scale invariant, as we'll be seeing it anyway. So if it's scale invariant, just to get to last scale, it's got to be scale invariant, then you say, well, you know, anything that generates it, other even if it were not inflation, would also be zero. You know, if you had asked those guys, they haven't known which people 40 years ago, they would say, sure, you can put in tensor mode.
Sure, they have a spectrum of NT equal to zero, plus or minus a small number. And you ask, well, how small is that number? They would have said, well, it's kind of small, it's less than one, you know, much less than one, it could be less than the largest small scale to the log of that, which they would have said is probably got to be within 10%. They probably would have said within 10% of zero, right? If you just take that argument, they would have said within 10% of zero, meaning it's very easy to 10 sigma to be at all interesting, and to just show it's not scale invariant, and then to test that it's actually a prediction which is different from what those guys would have said 1%. So let's make a statement, saying something other than just saying it's there and it's scale invariant, which is only a generic statement, not a position statement. Similarly, an inflation, of course, does predict three-point correlation functions. And those are all also, unfortunately, rather difficult. They're very small. They turn out to be rather small and observationally difficult to measure. And again, given their smallness, given that FNL, the equivalent of FNL is like 0.05 or something from generic inflation, there's not a good thought out there of how you actually might go and measure that either. So all these, in principle, position quantitative position forecasts all seem to be relatively out of reach of things that one is considering in the Cohen's program or measurement as well. If you want to go after one of these, what else might you do to test one of these things precisely? Well, so it's been that's many futuristic thinking theorists to think about a population of sources called 21 centimeter structures. And there have been a series of papers from including people like Matthias Dallaiaga and myself and Anthony Lewis and others who didn't escape to notice that you could in principle measure up to say 10 to the 18 modes, number of observable modes in 21 centimeter in our Hubble volume. that ambitious thinking to say that this is the, if you take the Hubble scale, take the number of, you know, gene pixels, gene volumes in the Hubble scale at redshift 15, then this number is something like 10 to the 18. Okay, so this is roughly what you might ambitiously try to measure. And as we know, when you measure a power spectrum, the accuracy on things like amplitude scales as the square root of the number of modes. So you could measure something to maybe 8 significant digits. Okay, you could measure an amplitude or a number, a statistical Gaussian parameter to 8 significant digits if you had all these things. And with 8 significant digits, all of a sudden, you know, you're thinking maybe you could measure this something like the scale attempt ratio to 10 to minus 8. That'd be interesting because 10 to minus 8, you know, even secondarily produced tensor modes would be observable. FNLs as plugins go to N, you know, you could get things like 10 minus 4. So if people have been looking at this number and saying, well, you know, this is the root of that is well below the sensitivity needed to make non-trivial tests of inflation or any other model that might be intriguing. Just to explain a bit about redshift 15 is the redshift which actually maximizes the information. So there was the early papers used to think about a redshift of 80 or something, which takes it down to maybe 10 megahertz, which is difficult on the ground because of ionosphere. People have been talking about going to the backside of the moon to try to, you know, get rid of ionospheric effects. And so this has been thought to be, you know, very, very futuristic. I'm not claiming this is going to happen tomorrow, but it is actually not as futuristic, I think, as the initial thoughts were. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, filling the whole backside of the moon with dipoles here. That is fairly futuristic. But rather, you have to just remember that the gene scale, okay, because the universe is expanding and cooling, the gene scale actually is shrinking rapidly. So going to high redshift actually is a bad direction to go. The volume does not increase, and the co-moving number of modes actually is a finite number as you go to redshift of infinity. The co-moving visible horizon is a finite co-moving radius, meaning that going to high redshift really, you know, is only a small incremental gain. So the distance, the co-moving distance change from 15 to infinity is only about 20% in co-moving volume. And at the same time, the gene scale is increasing rapidly as you go to high redshift. Universe is hotter, right? A hot universe has a longer gene scale, meaning that there are fewer modes. The way to see a mode is you want it to be washed out by thermal fluctuation. So there is a natural sweet spot, and then you say, well, the lower the better. Unfortunately, there's a lower bound, which is 10, because we know from WMAP polarization that the universe reionizes at a redshift somewhere around 10. So if there's no 21 centimeter left, then that's a bad place to measure it. You want to measure it when there still is 21 centimeter radiation from neutral hydrogen. So you know it's somewhere above 10, and I'm just saying 15 being a number bigger than 10 and not much, much bigger than 10. Okay, that's fine. Nobody knows where the real sweet spot is, but roughly it's a number bigger than 10, but not much bigger than 10. And if you want to pick your favorite number, if you guess it's as good as anybody else's, it's what the actual optimal redshift is. Now, 15 is not too bad, so that's a frequency of about, you know, 80 megahertz or so, which is actually accessible. In fact, it's been getting better. That it used to be TV channels 227. If anybody still has a TV at home, you may notice that most places don't broadcast on these low frequency channels anymore because everybody wants to watch HD, and HD is difficult to both receive and broadcast. And in these low frequencies, because you need a higher bandwidth. So most TV channels actually these days have shifted into the upper VHF or UHF regime. So this band is actually, you know, it's becoming more accessible thanks to the people wanting to watch World Cup in HD. There are also several experiments underway to measure, to probe regimes which could cover the redshift 15. So this is a regime that there are currently experiments probing, and I'll explain a bit more about observational prospects of this. This is also suitable for existing other telescopes that, again, haven't been looking there because of interference and other issues that, again, one should start thinking about going back to these intermediate frequencies, so not ultra-high redshift, but redshifts that are tractable from the ground. Now, that's going back to the general agenda here of trying to measure, you know, some really tiny effect. The state of the art right now, well, depending on the exact measurement you have, but it's somewhere around a number a little bit less than 1, 6.24, depending on the exact interpretation of each data set. But it's somewhere in this regime that we currently have an upper bound for the scalar tensor ratio, where, of course, that's why if you divide this by 8, this means that the expected deviation from scale invariance of the tensor spectral index is probably less than 0.03 or something. So that's why, you know, you want to make a 1% measurement of NT to actually measure the deviation. Right? It's like saying you measure a deviation from NS. You know, all these things pretty good. This requires, and even that it has just barely been detected. You know, the deviation of the redness of the spectral index is barely at the limit of detectability. And you've got to have a similar position, or maybe even higher. If R turns out to be 0.01, then life clearly could be much, much harder. There's no limit to how hard life might be if this R gets to be small, because there's no hard prediction of what its value is. And then, of course, as you can see, you know, people are, you know, in an optimistic scenario, maybe you could measure an R down to 0.01, meaning you might get a couple of frequency detection on R. If R were close to this limit and sensitivity were substantially further, you might get the amplitude to, 30% if you're lucky with an experiment concentrating on large angular scales, simply because you need a large number of modes to measure a power amplitude. Okay, the accuracy of measuring anything is equal to the number of modes. And if you only measure to an L of 10, well, there are only 100 modes, so you'll never measure anything better than about 15-20%. That's just the cosmic variance limit to how many modes you have. So to do better, you've got to go to high K. Okay, you've got to see in order to get small angular scales, in order to get many modes. And then the question is, this normally is said to be really non-trivial because gravity wave, tensor modes, once they enter the horizon, redshift away. And when they redshift away, that is, makes it even harder to detect. Okay, so not only do you need to go to small angular scales to have many modes, when you go to small angular scales, the modes aren't there anymore. So this is not a good regime to be trying to test this. If everything seems to be working against any hope. So, you know, everything goes against this. And then the question is, you know, even in an ideal world, how might you go about this? Of course, right now we know a promising technique is to use the microwave background B-mode polarization, which gets induced because you get tensor-like primary CMB fluctuations, a constant scatter of reionization structures. It's also been proposed that you could try to do a direct measurement of gravity waves. So instead of measuring the scattered photons of a reionized medium at redshift 10, Donaldson and company had also pointed out that gravity waves lead to gravitational lensing distortions. Okay, that they lead to apparent changes. I mean, polarization is a real change, but they're also apparent changes, and of course we know that gravitational lensing has been one of the key programs to measure dark matter, and as we know, these are metric fluctuations, and you could have metric tensor fluctuations, which will also, of course, lead to gravitational lensing. And they have pointed out that if you had enough sources, meaning 10 to the 10, then you might have a chance of getting R. Now, 10 to the 10 might sound, 10 to the 10 is not that futuristic. If you look at, you know, what people at Cohen's surveys like LST are proposing, that's in that range. So the number of sources that people hoping to measure actually starts to compete just brute force, just by, you know, just measuring the, you know, third of n shear of each little galaxy object to measure mean distortion on the sky. So this is in a regime that may almost be tractable. And then you say, well, if with a measly 10 to the 10 object, you can get an interesting bound on R, then if you have 10 to the 18, you know, it's 8 orders of magnitude more, you know, maybe you can start doing interesting measurements. So that's the basic backdrop, except you still have to fight this fact that your gravity waves might be decaying away on you, in which case, you know, this idea of going to high K and measuring multiple scales might seem not so well motivated. You might wonder. That's what students are for. So Kiyo looked at this problem a bit, seeing how far you could get, and came up with the amusing conclusion that there may be a linear memory effect of these tantamodes. Now, just in perspective, lensing, okay, is really a CMB lensing, for example, any lensing by a any kind of lensing effect is a second order effect. It is a metric fluctuation between you and the source that induces a change on the power on the source. So it's the coupling of modes to modes. All if you count by order, lensing is a second order effect. And this is of course also a second order effect they're going after. Except there are two places to look for it. One is the apparent distortion by looking at things, by gravity waves between you and the source, between you and the microwave background. And that's not the one that we normally measure. Okay, that's not the apparent one, that's actually a real, for example, the CMB, B mode comes from the actual Doppler shift of the photon through the wave itself, not something between us and the CMB. The lensing effect between us and the CMB is very small. CMB, when you want 10 to the 10 objects, the CMB does not have 10 to the 10 modes. So that's the wrong case. That's not going to do it. Even though the lensing effect qualitatively is the same idea. And again, here we'll note that in addition to apparent distortions, of course, there are actually real distortions as well of gravity waves in the source plane. Right? So the metric in the source plane gets distorted by gravity waves. Gravity waves will make the things at the source plane look anthropomorphic, intrinsically, not because of an illusion of us looking at them. And then, here, let's look at how this effect actually goes about, and what actually happens to this effect as gravity waves decay. So here it depends a little bit of the whole question of boils down to frames of how you to measure how something looks different. You've got to know how it looks before it was different. Making like a circular problem, but the way that Keogh explains it, I'll follow this explanation here because I took his slide. Is that in the general procedure in order to use this large n limit is that you have to use small scale modes from very high k to reconstruct a relatively low k gravity wave. Okay, we're talking about a k of maybe 100 or so for the scalar fluctuations, 100 megaparsec inverse, to reconstruct a k of let's say 1 or something, or 0.1. for the gravity wave. Okay, so we're trying to use many, many small little measurements to construct a relatively coherent distortion. So what you know is that, well, because the k of the gravity wave is small, it was generated earlier during inflation, if inflation was the mechanism that generated it, than the small scale scalar. Okay, so first they were tensors and then they were scalars when you're comparing the large scale to small scale. So first you draw, it's kind of hard to draw a transverse tracer thing on a 2D surface, but let's say you have just a wave on a surface, and you stretch it at inflation until it kind of leaves the horizon, until it gets relatively large compared to the local Hubble scale, and so take a tantamode that's well beyond your horizon. And then you ask, well, what frame do I should I now be choosing to generate my scalar perturbation? And normally we invoke the equivalence principle across the no hair, saying that the whole point of inflation is to get rid of all the stuff that happened long before a given mode is generated. That's that we can deal with a locally isotropic, Bunch-Davis vacuum that is basically thought of as Minkowski's as a isotropic space. But it's the De Sitter space in which the measurements are done by local observers in the local frame. Because the gravity wave because there was a gravity wave out there, of course the local frame is different than the frame that you would have described the system before the gravity wave left. The gravity wave cured the coordinates from before and after the gravity wave was there. So there are really two frames in which you could describe this system. This red circle was, this red circle was, make sure that it looks on this screen, that this red circle, if there was a circular, was a true circle before the gravity wave was generated. And then after the this fiducial circle, after the gravity wave is out at the horizon, and really now looks elongated. Doesn't really matter because it's all fiducial anyway. It's some serious imagining that you had standard yardsticks that, or co-moving paint yardsticks in space that you don't have. Anyways, and then you start generating little perturbations on small scales, okay, that are isotropic by in the local proper frame, okay, the proper fluctuations, know about proper distances, so you're going to make structures look isotropic in a proper, using proper distances. And, however, of course, if you describe it in a different frame, you would describe these perturbations as being anisotropic. Now, this is all, a gauge-dependent thing, and this is clearly not very real for somebody looking at these perturbations. Anybody who was around when they were generated would have said that I've taken my standard hockey stick and determined these to be round. So this the other frame clearly was just a bad frame to be describing anyway, so it's just hypothetical. But then, at late times, what happens, of course, the gravity wave enters our horizon first and then decays away. And afterwards, First, the small scale perturbations enter the horizon. And again, they appear around, okay? So they are isotropic. So if I sit around at redshift, let's say a million, and I watch all my little perturbations coming in, and all I had was these small perturbations and some super horizon gravity wave, I would never have known about that anyway, so I would have measured my perturbations and I would have concluded that they were round. Now, of course, a gravity wave enters. I mean, the gravity wave is always there. It's not a matter of entering. The gravity wave is almost always there. But the gravity wave enters and redshifts away. Okay. And at some point, this shear of 10 to the minus 5, for example, of the gravity wave will leave my local frame and as a topic in a proper yardstick. Right? So I'm going to measure my structures. BAO standing waves, or be it the power spectra itself, and I will conclude, well, actually, you know, because it was on before the gravity wave decayed, and after decayed, it will have changed by order H. So it leaves a memory of the decay. Okay, so you can only measure changes, you cannot measure absolute things, and there is a change when the gravity wave decays, and it is a change that's measurable and that persists.
Any other forces making them spherical?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's in the absence of the throwing forces between. Okay. So if you're simply looking at stars, which for example Donaldson points out that if your object is a galaxy or a star, then even if you squeeze it a bit, well, it'll restore it definitely round. However, if you're freely falling test particles, let's say cold dark matter or 20 centimeter neutral atoms, those you should think of freely falling test particles that have no pressure forces making them round again. So, I think free falling is the right question here. And stars would not work even though there are many stars. The stars actually are bad gravity wave detectors because they would thought themselves to be round in a sound forcing camera of the star. Yes?
The gravity waves. You will have gravity waves which were differently oriented, so if you average over it, the whole effect disappears, right?
There's no net shear, but there's a variation in shear. That's like lensing,
right? If you say, well, if I average over a large patch, sure, there's no net lensing on large scale, of course. On the other hand, there is a variance, meaning that any given patch does get sheared by order gamma. So same here. So a typical pattern observed at the end of the day still has a distortion of order 10 minus 5, and it'll be different in different directions. But because it's a scale invariant spectrum, and on almost all scales that are smooth like that, it'll still be roughly 10 minus 5 modulo log factors because of the scale invariant and perturbation. Okay, the amusing thing is, yes, it does depend on scale, but it's always a similar number independent of your smoothing scale. So here we have the decay of the gravity wave resulting in an anisotropy of the subsequent matter power spectrum. And that you can try to observe. And of course, anisotropy can be both real or apparent, and gravitational lensing has developed the whole machinery to discuss apparent distortions. And for this purpose, statistically, there's no difference. You have a Gaussian, it's still Gaussian, just an anisotropic Gaussian random field now. And we know that Gaussian, but it's still
at least over in the regime that you have passed is small compared to the perturbation scale, it is still a stationary, a homogeneous but anisotropic process. So you can still apply Gaussian estimators. You can do the same thing as you do with lensing, as with CMB lensing, and you apply what's called quadratic estimators. So you have some perturbation variable called delta, and the way you construct estimators is you take gradients of these things and you take outer part of the gradient. So the 2-point terms, which contain all information for Gaussian random fields, even with anisotropy, will be the optimal estimators for your local metric shear. So these things are linearly in there, and of course that's kind of obvious because these derivatives are metric dependent. So what you will observe will depend on, as you change your gauge, these things really change depending on on what frame of differentiation relative to. So the coupling of metric in here just comes from the derivative differentiation, and you're always observing metrics. Okay. Then,
well, it's optimal if you filter k by k. It has because this is a non-linear operation in real space.
And to make it optimal, it's just a matter of filtering the delta by the appropriate window to make it optimal. So optimality is just before you do the non-linear, the quadratic operation, you've got to do some linear filtering.
Sorry, doesn't it? It depends on the power spectrum of delta. Okay. And the limit that your perturbation, that your lensing effects are small, it doesn't really matter whether you use the pre-lens, the post-lens power spectrum. They are the same as this order, so you only need to know the either pre or post-lens power spectrum.
Confusion is that in the context of CMB, people have this quadratic estimators and then optimal estimators, and they're significantly different.
Quadratic estimator is a generic term, and optimal estimators are also quadratic. Okay, so amongst the class of quadratic estimators, there exists an optimal version thereof, but it's still quadratic. It's still a two-point function on the field because for Gaussian random field, that's all there.
Yeah, but if it's a nonlinear effect, you might wonder because basically you're trying to study the H and J from the correlation on the P on the power spectrum.
Yes.
For example, you might wonder that the four-point function estimator among the two-point function estimator, this is probably the optimal.
It's still Gaussian, right?
It's an assumption effect.
No, it's Gaussian. It's like CMB lensing. CMB lensing, if you share the CMB, it's an apparent change of coordinates. It's the same thing, an apparent change of coordinates. Now, and when you say Gaussianity, there are multiple stages of Gaussianity. You can have Gaussian that is stationary, or stationary and isotropic. Okay, isotropic has got two meanings. Different people use it different ways. But if I think of a three-dimensional field, if my variance is different in one direction than the other, but independent of x or y, I can still call this stationary. But I don't call it isotropic because my variance is axis dependent. Okay, but it's still Gaussian. And stationary, but not isotropic. And that's what we're talking about here.
It's still stationary and Gaussian, but not isotropic, meaning that my power spectrum actually has a quadrupolar nature. It's still
Gaussian.
H is another Gaussian.
That's a local statement.
Yes.
Yeah, the local statement.
But if you look at lots of hashes, then it's only statistically isotropic. I mean, it'll still be statistically isotropic.
Absolutely, the whole thing, yes. Now remember that we're working the limit that our modes are small compared to the modes that we construct. Meaning that the smoothing scale, if I only care about H's on relatively large scales, because there's not enough signals to reconstruct small scale H now, it's just in practice, even though they are tantamount to small scales, you'll never have enough modes to talk about them. You'll always be in the regime where the scalar modes you're measuring are much, much higher k than the tantamount you're trying to construct, meaning patch by patch, I should be thinking of it as a stationary but anisotropic process.
Patch by patch.
Yes. Patch by patch.
Because the moment you go to Fourier space, right, all the spatial information is all mixed together.
No, there are two different spaces. So there's a scale at which h varies, which would be, you know, let's say a gigaparsec. Okay? And then there's a scale where this delta varies, which is like a kiloparsec. So these are all, that would be six orders of magnitude. So, you know, in a given survey,
the survey volume might be very small compared to the large scale. And because you've got a nonlinear operation here, the squaring is a nonlinear operation. What matters is, these Fourier of this is not the same as the Fourier of that. They're two different Fourier spaces. So what I mean is, when you do the Fourier transform of this, you pick a patch to do the Fourier transform. It turns out it doesn't actually matter. You actually go through the details.
because the scales are so well separated, it really didn't matter what you did, whether you included this perturbation in here or not, it will not have any impact. It turns out, because these separations are small, ignoring that, the short answer is yes, but that's only second order effects. The first order, if you ignore it, you still get roughly the same sensitivity, ignoring it as well. Yeah. Now, you might wonder that, as we know, lensing also has an effect. You know, would you ever be able to separate this from gravitational lensing, which is, instead of being 10 minus 5, it's 10%. They got a 4 order of magnitude larger apparent distortion of any structure in the sky, or a few percent at least, is the typical lensing induced anisotropy. Would you ever be able to tell apart a shear? And that's what lensing does. It shears and magnifies everything else. And if I say, you know, gravity waves is also a shear, how can I tell a shear from a shear? And here the answer is there is a fundamental difference. And you can think of it, and it's not just a perturbative difference, it is a fundamental difference, that a lensing, if you wish, is a relabeling of coordinates. But I give you a map, and somebody put a coordinate system down, and somebody else relabeled my coordinate system and didn't tell me what it was. I've got a new coordinate, he did a gauge transformation, and didn't tell me what the gauge transformation was. Fine, I don't know my gauge, but I know there was a gauge transformation, meaning that if I construct any tensorial, any curvature invariant, I know that those have to transform as either scalars or tensors. And for example, scalars, if I split scalar, you know, the squared and summit, I know that those cannot be changed by gauge transformation. Okay, so there are things that are invariant, and there are things that are not invariant. And it turns out gravity waves will always, will not allow you to pick, so I can ask back again, can I find a gauge in which my curvature is zero, for example? And the answer for lensing is yes. I can always, you know, undo my lensing by finding a gauge where the effect wasn't there. If I had a true metric perturbation, like a gravity wave, you will find that no matter what I do to my field, there will never exist a transformation which will get rid of a gravity wave. It cannot be gauged away, at least not over a full period of a wave. Yeah.
It's all about for strong lensing. Coordinate changes don't have to be small. Right? So that's the gauge nature. It's just a relabeling of coordinates.
If I have make two objects out of one object, how can I have two images out of one object, how is that a coordinate transformation?
Well, I mean, we're getting into details here. I mean, yes, you have to deal with a finite number of these things that you've got to reconstruct at the same time. I mean, yes, when you do reconstruction, you'll find that this mapping is really not one-to-one and on-to, but it's still a mapping, right? Once I figure it out, I can tell you what it looked like before I lensed it. So once I've undone it, you know, it's clear that I can still determine this mapping, which is not one-to-one and on-to, but I can still figure it out and undo it.
Having multiple images doesn't prevent me from in principle undoing it. So it is intrinsically different from lensing, and another way of putting it is that these estimators are transverse and traceless, whereas lensing-induced changes can only not transverse and traceless if you want a perturbative explanation of this. Okay. Perturbatively, it's different, and qualitatively, it's always different, meaning that this is this is a non-contaminable effect, meaning that there is a hope that we might be able to go after this, even in the presence of lensing contaminants. Again, the effect is small, so you need a lot of modes to do it. I think I'm short of time, so I'm just going to skip over this slide, which I've pretty much already said, and go back to sensitivities you could try to achieve. So if you put in telescopes that are currently on the drawing board, you find that, for example, an R, you can detect what might be 7, which is not particularly interesting, but that's a telescope which is never meant to do this. We're just, you know, just pick a random telescope that people talk about building. It's not a cheap one, but it's a random one. It's pretty much random in the sense that this was not one of the goals in mind when they built it, that you can actually get something which is not off the order of magnitude, but in the right, in a relevant range, that might be interesting. And then you can say, well, now imagine what would it take to actually make an interesting measurement out of this. And it turns out, well, you just have to, you know, have a bit more collecting area at low frequencies. And at low frequencies, as a square kilometer is not such an expensive exercise. In fact, even LOFAR has close to a square kilometer collecting area already. So, you know, if this became one of your priorities, you could certainly increase this by a factor of 100, I think, without much without substantial change in the total project cost. You made this a one of the science drivers to this. But as I said, the interesting thing you'd like to do is test the consistency relation, but that's a real challenging part. I mean, we've got other ways of going after, and even here I just want to point out the sweet spot of measuring 21 centimeter at redshift, and I said 15, and that wasn't pulled completely out of thin air because my colleagues who model spin temperature evolution also point out that the spin temperature is probably most observable at redshift 15 because of the effect of laminar pumping, meaning that the effect actually at redshift 15 is larger than the effect during reionization. Okay, so the single largest 21 centimeter structure, the most observable structure really is at redshift 15, period. So it's easier in some sense than any other 21 centimeter experiment currently under discussion. It's the easiest regime and has the most information. Of course, the other things that that people are going after the reionization of redshift 10 have not been detected yet either. So it's about, let's say, you know, but everybody thinks we'll get there within the next few years, so hopefully we'll cover both of these regimes. You also see that there is some theoretical forecast scatter depending on who does the forecasting, so it's not the temperature evolution is not a perfectly well understood phenomenon.
Isn't the synchrotron going to be bigger by a factor of 8 or something? Or
factor
of 10.
15, yeah, it was a 15 over 10 cubes, roughly.
Right.
Which is very much bigger. Of 4 or whatever. Yeah, it's like a 4 bigger, but again, the fashion effect is a factor of, you know, 8 bigger.
I mean, the fashion effect that people are going after at reionization, they're talking about a warm medium which has about a 20 millikelvin. So this is 20 millikelvin, this is 150. So the effect is about larger by a similar amount as the synchrotron goes up. In fact, it's a bit more. You actually win a bit. But it depends a little bit of, you know, which of these lines are taken, where exactly I put it. But so within, you know, where people think it happens, this may, okay. It may be easier or harder depending on the details of where you put that line. But it's comparable. It's comparable in technical challenge as the reionization itself. Okay, so, and so the good news is that this is not trivial, but may not be, you know, this next millennium problem, but rather this decade problem of trying to go after these redshift 15 structures. So, and especially if there is a science case to be made, that can motivate you to sort of go after this earlier. I think otherwise, okay, why not? Would you ever care about redshift 15 anyways? And here are reasons why you might care. So here is if you actually do a forecast on power spectra on what you might do on a given experiment that can go after reasonably ambitious baselines. This is, I think, 1,000 kilometer baselines or so. So it's ambitious, but not totally crazy. Well, if you ask. And this is the amplitude of the power spectrum of tensor modes as a function of k. And now you can say, well, how accurately do you have to measure something to tell a deviation, right? So in units of k cubed t of k, a scale invariant spectrum would be a horizontal line. And what the challenge is to an experiment is to measure this thing at enough different scales with a small enough error that they could tell a slope on that line from a horizontal one. And I don't know whether with these specific sets of parameters, supposedly you get a 2 sigma detection of a deviation from flatness. Okay. So it says that with these specific parameters and an R of 0.1, which is an optimistic value of R, well, I mean, optimistic is saying that this is consistent with upper bounds, and yet optimistic saying that this is actually tractable in the not so far future. You actually, with these, and an ambitious experiment, but not total, not like really futuristic, but an ambitious experiment, you have a chance of measuring the consistency relation. Yes?
In homogeneous reionization, this laminar photon pumping, that could be homogeneous. All of those could add the asperious, but add asperious modulation and fluctuation.
Yeah, good question. We have not.
Okay.
Luckily I'm out of time, so I don't have to answer your question anymore. that the conclusion really is that Kiri here has been working on this linear memory effect that we talked about here with fossils that may improves the detectability. It doesn't make it trivial, but makes it not quite as ridiculously hard as it normally might be to measure the interpar spectrum on different scales because of linear memory. And the last reason to measure the metric locally, patch by patch, that's the way I like to think about what this does, is also to measure a metric everywhere. And that's the measurements of metrics are unaffected by, luckily, certain things. And that this has a potential that there's a sweet spot, and that this sweet spot, relation 15, is both a theoretical and an experimentally desirable spot to be in. And it's something one should start looking at now. Right? This is not something for the far, far future in the backside of the moon. This is something to be done with the current generation of telescopes to beat hard at this redshift, which may hold more information and be more tractable. May is the word here. We don't know. The astrophysics is not well enough known to say exactly how easy it is. And it is a opportunity to measure.
Okay. Do you know how these constraints on R or NT compare to something you can get from CMB experiment? I was trying to look at the numbers.
Okay, so the only other one I'm aware of measuring NT involves measuring, say, using a Big Bang observer or something, measuring the Fermi waves, like here, like use a long lever arm. So CMB is not hope.
I'm thinking something like B-fall.
That's no hope. No, NT, that's no hope.
But for an R that is that large,
it doesn't matter. 0.24 even. 0.24, as I said, even at the current upper bound, it's impossible because you would need, you would need thousands of modes. Even at the current upper bound,
but it depends on the error modes. Depends on the error value you want.
I think this story is CMB up to like L of several hundred. I mean, cosmic variance is so big on the scales of gravitational waves, it's effectively wrong.
So I was trying to compare the error on R you get with the error on R.
Well, the error on R for the final experiment is like 10 to the minus 5.
Ah,
it's,
okay.
It's tiny.
So
tiny.
The error on NT then for an R of 0.1?
Sorry?
For an R of 0.1, what's the error on NT?
For an R of 0.1, the error on NT, this is 2 sigma, so from 0.001. Right? So this means that the error on NT is 0.0005. And that's
what
you want to be interested in. That's way ahead of anything we can talk about. But that's what you need to be what I call interesting, right?
Okay.
So on Tuesday, I'm sure you recall it perfectly at NBC, I actually showed exactly what the CMB fault can do in an ideal world. And it's not able to, it shrinks the error bars, but it's not really a test of consistency. It's just too difficult to get such precision.
Mm-hmm. Is the NT of 0.1 or something?
It's a little bit sloppier than that. It's basically the same reason Kobe didn't do a very good job on getting a slope, because it's just not a large enough lever arm.
So for this forecasting, you basically assume just linear power spectrum and completely smooth Lyman alpha coupling everywhere in the universe?
Yeah.
Right. So, but if you include the fact that the Lyman alpha is coming from actual sources and it's going to be, inhomogeneous, that would complicate things, right?
Inhomogeneous. Again, if it's from a scalar-like field, if it's an intensity field that intrinsically is scalar, you might be able to model it out if all you have is an intensity field modulating it. If you had vector field modulating it or tensor field modulating it.
You went to slightly higher redshifts than... You don't actually need the Lyman alpha. It's coupled at redshift 20 anyway.
Yes.
Okay. So how much harder would that be?
Well, that's why people want to go to the backside of the moon. And also, actually, the theoretical limit is worse because the gene size is longer, right? I mean, yes, you can do it, but I think this would become... I'm not sure it's possible, even in an ideal world at redshift 80, just because the gene size starts becoming longer than this k you need to constrain it. That's my guess. I guess we should start to look at that as well. But like Gataldo, even in an ideal world, okay, even when even if you're back to the moon and have infinite money, like Gataldo from the Gene Snakes.
So, what k's dominate this for the HIJ? Which wave numbers?
So we're using a k of 168 in the 21 centimeters, so we construct a k of 0.05 in the
nice. What is the k of the HIJ which dominates the effect?
Which dominates the for NP.
This measurement, yeah. Which k's are relevant?
Where does this measure the gravitational wave spectrum the best?
Where?
It measures the best at a k, in this case, of 0.02. Right? That's more of the L bar. That's what my pivot point, so the best pivot point.
That is the k of the gravitational
wave. Of gravity wave, yeah. This is the k of gravity wave.
Yeah, I see.
0.02 is the one I measure best, and to measure a tilt, I need to measure a range of these guys.
So these waves entered the horizon just after recombination?
No. These waves, the horizon goes as
a bit earlier.
As well as the redshift, so it's at horizon button minus 3, it's about 30 horizon lengths, so 1,000 times, 10 to the 4, yeah, 10 to the 4 is when they were there.
Yeah, so just before recombination.
Yeah.
And what, if you scaled up the experiment, you'll be measuring modes which entered later?
Well, this is ambitious. This is already assuming that I can measure the whole Hubble volume today up to a... So this is a cosmic variance limit of how well I can... If I measure every single value in our Hubble volume, right?
I thought you said 200 gigaparsecs.
Well, that's where I have where I have the maximum number of modes, assuming I get them all. I think with the lower k, there's fewer modes. Our cosmic variance limit gives us fewer modes, so if we go this way... I mean, the examples are pretty small, right? This is an implicit measurement of a power spectrum, but there aren't that many modes at k of 10 to minus 3 for gravity waves in our Hubble volume. So this is a pretty hard cosmic variance limited exercise.
Could you improve it? Like, if r would be 0.1, then probably Planck or some other experiment would also see the
yes.
Limitation. Could you improve your level r by including CMB data, or would it not change?
It makes almost no change, because you need this 1% measurement, and even though the CMB measures about 10 to minus 3, right? 10 to minus 3, and your error bar is about a factor of, I don't know, 30%. So even though you gain by going there, it turns out that the... Since most sensitivity on the slope is given all around the point where you measure it best, and even if you throw away everything below here, it doesn't make much difference to your slope measurements.
Okay, well, this will probably leave it. Brian, we're running a bit late, so let's thank you.